Welcome to Spark Your Fire podcast, sparking your interest in Australian property and finance. Now, here's your host, Jazz. But before that, let's listen to the quote of the week.
Here's the key. Learn from every mistake, because every experience, encounter, and particularly your mistakes are there to teach you and force you into being more of who you are. And then figure out what is the next right move. What is your true calling? What is your dharma?
Listeners, welcome to the show once again. We've got Daniel on the show today. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you very much, Jazz, for having me.
Do you want to give a quick background to listeners maybe on your experience in this space?
Yep, sure, no problem at all. Probably most of your listeners weren't even born when I got started in 1985. So I did a commerce degree at university, and I became a stockbroker. Specifically, I became an equities share analyst in the late 1980s. So I saw the 1987 crash, which was quite an experience. And I used to analyse all the balance sheets, the P&Ls, cash flows for the Australian transport building materials companies, as well as the food sector. I then decided that I'd move overseas, and I actually changed firms and I moved to London. And then I moved in specifically into institutional equity sales. So I've always worked at that end of the market. So I've never done private clients specifically. It's been more superannuation funds, hedge funds, unit trusts, the like. And I specialised in emerging markets in the 1990s. So I was very lucky to be able to stockbroke to some of the largest clients in the world, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand. And then I moved on to global emerging markets until it all went a little bit pear-shaped with the 1997 Asian currency crisis and Russia defaulting on its corporate sovereign debt. And then you had long-term capital management, which was probably one of the first systemic risk to the financial system. And cutting it short, I then gave up my career and moved back to Australia to have my son, and I've been raising him. He's now at university, and I've been managing my own money for about the last 13 years, having dabbled around with other people managing it up until the GFC, when I decided, no, I'm taking control of this. So I've got perspective from both a professional and a personal capacity.
Also, a lot of experience over there. And you also have written a book recently. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the book as well?
Yeah. So I've actually wrote another book about total wealth creation and all the traps along the way. That one, the publisher goes, yeah, great, but no, we want something a little bit simpler. How about something on share investing? And I said, yep, that's easy to do. So Shareplicity, a simple approach to share investing, was created. And it's a book designed for anyone through from new investors to more experienced investors. And it starts from woe to go to really educate everybody about how they can become involved at some level with share investing.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Danielle, how do you see the current market environment for anyone who's trying to get their feet dirty in this space? How to get started? What's your take on the markets currently?
Sure. Well, the first thing is I am not a registered advisor, so take this as it is. It's, you know, this is not advice. It's general in nature. But basically how I see the market at the moment, these are very challenging times for obvious reasons. We've got a global health crisis going on, which is having a material impact on economies. And what has caused the experts the largest amount of concern, or let's say they can't understand what's happening, is the disconnect between what's going on in the economies and what's happening in the share market, as in the share markets have rallied very, very sharply off their March lows. And I think that has really been quite challenging for a lot of investors because they go, how can this be happening? We have a long period of economic contraction that we really can't see how we're going to come out of this until we actually have a change in the health dynamics, which is a vaccine, basically. So in terms of how to start investing, I think it's really important that you have to pick what you're trying to achieve that suits your own risk profile. So it's quite hard to talk generally, but if it's somebody that's new to the market and you want to get exposure to shares, a very good way to do it is to actually say, I might just buy an ETF on the ASX 200, for example, or on the S&P 500, or the largest companies in the world. And you can actually add to that ETF over time. So you do what's called dollar cost averaging. But it really depends how much you want to dive down into the share market and whether you have a penchant for growth, because there's a lot of stuff going on in the growth sector, particularly over in America and China, although I'm not across China as well, or whether you're looking for more the traditional type of old economy stocks. And in Australia, there's and overseas, you see it. You've got the cheap valuations of the old economy stocks, and then you've got the much more heady valuations that is going on in the FANGs and the Teslas overseas.
Do you think the market overall is a little bit disconnected from what's going on with the economy, and it's way too overpriced? And what are some of the indicators that you would look at to figure out whether it is overpriced or not? Like, different people will look at different things, whether it's the Cape-Shiller ratio or whether it's the, if traders will look at the 200-day moving average, that kind of things. Do you have any personal indicators preferred that helps you decide whether it's now is the time to enter or exit the market, kind of thing?
It's really hard because timing the market can be quite difficult. And I think you need to, if you're going to take a market perspective, to me, everything clearly looks expensive at the moment. It doesn't really matter on what metric you look at, whether you look at price to earnings ratios, whether you look at sales to revenue, whether you look at trading charts. Clearly, there's been a big, big run. So if you're putting money in at this level, you have to take a longer term approach. You always need to differentiate. Are you going to buy the index with an ETF, or are you actually going to look at stocks separately? Because within the whole array of stocks that are out in the market, you may find shares, some of them are trading very, very cheaply, like low PERs, and haven't participated in this recovery. You just need to be a little bit careful when you do that. One thing is that they may never recover to the prices that they were in the past, because the industry has structurally changed for a long period of time, or the business may not survive. But part of the disconnect has actually come about because central banks around the world are trying to keep the financial wheels going. We can't afford to go into what happened in March, which was when a very few large hedge funds got into trouble and they had to have mass liquidations, which forced all asset prices to come down. So we have to understand that everybody now, through their superannuation funds, has to a smaller or larger degree some exposure to this form of asset class. And central banks have worked out post the GFC and more recently that they just can't let the system down. And this is what happens. You get these calamitous pullbacks in the share market, then the central banks have to come in, pump in the liquidity and keep it going. But of course, they can't do it in perpetuity. So when you see them start to pull back, it often coincides with the markets actually starting to tail off a bit. The long and the short of it is, I wouldn't personally just be buying at this point in time. For me, you're coming into reporting season in Australia, you're seeing reporting season over in the US, and you've seen in the big tech stocks over there, they've reported some great results, but the share prices have come down in response. And what's that is indicating is that the market has already discounted those great results coming out in the US. In Australia, it's very much an unknown quantity. You're literally going to have to wait and see as each company announces, because a lot of them have withdrawn guidance as to, A, if you look through the rearview mirror, how they've gone for the last 12 months, but also, too, are they going to give us any indication of what's going to happen in the next 12 months? And we're living in very uncertain times.
I mean, with the that much stimulus that has been provided, and if they if they start to wind that back a little bit, it'll be interesting to see what happens with a lot of these companies, whether which ones will survive, which one will won't.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to be head of a central bank at the moment. They've certainly got their work cut out for them, because it's a fine line between how do you let, you know, certain companies go bust, mm-hmm. because that's the cleansing process that economies should go through. You should be allowed to get companies go bust. But of course, at the moment, they don't want to set in chain, you know, a whole lot of losses and then people having to redeem other assets. And that's the problem. They've kind of got themselves into a bit of a corner at the moment, you know, which makes it challenging.
Yeah. Now, with the COVID, like we were saying just before, things are changing structurally over here, right? So do you see some of the sectors outperforming over the next, even though they may be expensive now, but they will outperform over the next couple of years compared to the likes of in the past, like our energy sector or technology sector, as an example? Blockchain is another one, which how do you invest in it? That's another story.
Okay. So in the book Shareplicity, I discuss quality shares, and I still subscribe to that. Quality shares have strong competitive advantages. It's what Warren Buffett calls a moat. They have strong balance sheets. They have good cash flow generation. They have the ability to disrupt themselves, and they can also grow in long-term secular markets. Mm-hmm. We're in unique times at the moment. I think the whole COVID health crisis has accelerated changes that were already in place. So when you look at the technological disruption that's been occurring, you know, for the last 20 years, it's really started to move forward since the dot-com crash. Mm. And I think this health crisis has actually given those companies that are at the cutting edge of being able to adapt. So, okay, you look at the e-commerce giants, you look at the healthcare companies that are now operating in the telehealth or med tech sector, you look at the streaming services, all these things that were moving ahead anyway have been brought forward. Mm-hmm. Personally, I am a strong subscriber that you should be part of this change that is going on. I'm probably quite unusual for someone in my age group and demographics, etc. I'm kind of have a propensity in a risk-adjusted basis to be an investor in change makers. So the likes of the Teslas of the world. Of course, I don't put everything in there, and you never want to just put everything into one investment. It's called diversification. But for young investors, I really would not be going down the old value cyclical stocks necessarily. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in Australia, everybody used to hold the banks. They used to hold Telstra. You know, yes, they had BHP or Rio Tinto. Banks, I think, are fundamentally challenged going forward. Mm-hmm. There's going to be disruption. You've got a low interest rate environment that's not going to disappear. And you've got huge property exposure. And, of course, there's a question mark over that at the moment. Mm-hmm. In terms of where the cutting edge stuff is, it is all on the digital platforms and all the ancillary services that come around those. So, for example, if you look at a Shopify, an e-commerce growing, you know, giant, there are a whole lot of software companies, ancillary services that are operating around there, whether it's cloud-based security systems, whether it's the contactless payment systems, whether it's just facilitating the actual platform. And to me, it's just going to keep on going that way. The question is all the near-term growth discounted at the share prices at this point in time? And obviously, they've had a huge run. So you could argue, I think, yes, they are, but they'd be on my watch list when they pull back, and it could be a severe pullback, because what the market tends to do, it tends to rotate out of growth and then go back into value. And you see it all the time. It just goes into the fangs, and then it goes, oh, no, we're going to go back and we're going to go into value. We'll go and buy all those bombed out airlines or the cruise ships. And they do the same thing in Australia. Mm-hmm. But I think the future, really, our economies, we're going to look back and say we didn't realise what such a seminal moment in time we were actually living through. And, you know, so I'm a proponent of good quality growth companies at the right price.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. That's cool. ETF is one way of going about investing in a particular sector, a bunch of shares, basically. But for the people who cannot read financial statements, or the investors who cannot read financial statements, right? Does that mean that investing in the individual stocks is just not a possible option? Or how do these people go about trying to handpick the stocks, basically? There's obviously so many of them. Market is open forum. There's traders, there's punters, there's investors. The point that I'm trying to make is, as an investor, as a newcomer into this space, how do you actually gain an edge if you're trying to handpick the shares instead of buying the whole sector?
Yeah, it takes time and it takes experience. So the first thing is that experience matters. Mm-hmm. And you unfortunately have to experience the wonderful highs of making money and feeling inviscerated when you've been absolutely slammed when it's a stock that hasn't worked out, because you investors need to learn to sell. There are numerous platforms. So I always say, I used to be the equities analyst that would do all the analysis of the P&Ls and the balance sheets. As retail investors, it's not necessarily our job to be the expert in that arena.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to find where your level of expertise is, and everyone's going to be a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
I look for quality shares in secular growth markets that I feel over time will produce a dividend income stream, because mm-hmm. that's me. I also try and protect my capital. If you are younger, like my son, he probably is going to be more a momentum player. So mm-hmm. look at the trends and the momentum. And mm-hmm. therefore he will go, well, I like that sector, and I'll take a top-down approach. So a top-down approach is, you know, you want to be part of the e-commerce revolution, or you think that Australia is going to continue to sell a lot of iron ore to China. So you mm-hmm. would buy the big miners. It takes some research for a start, read Shareplicity, because it'll give you lots of ideas how to identify the different sectors and what you're actually looking for. But also you need to find reliable platforms to seek out information.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, you had a speaker, Rudy Filipek van Dijk. I use FN Arena personally. Mm-hmm. It's the best $440 or whatever it is a year mm-hmm. because it gives me access to the earnings forecasts and the dividend forecasts for over 400 Australian companies. It gives me share price targets, and it gives me moving averages, and plus you get commentary on a whole lot of sectors.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very hard for retail investors because there is almost too much information out there now.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I tend to adopt the approach that until you're comfortable to dip your toe in the water, mm-hmm. just sit back, possibly do some research, do some reading, get a level of comfort, even just get used to buying an ETF on the market, and then start to watch what are the stocks underlying the ETF mm-hmm. that are moving the market, and maybe start to understand why that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
So in a bull market, you will get everything going up, mm-hmm. right? Everything goes up. You can literally, it's like shooting fish in a barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a little bit like that over in America lately. As I said to my son, I get these messages coming through, oh, wow, look at this. And I say, darling, it's not realistic. You can't expect this to continue at the rate it's continuing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem is now investors get, they suddenly hear about somebody that's, you know, made so much money on Afterpay, and they think, I want the next Afterpay. I want the next Afterpay. And mm-hmm. the problem is that they're rare. They're not the general company. And so whatever you do, when you start to find a share, if somebody goes, I've got a hot tip for you, the best advice that anyone can ever give is just don't put everything into it. If you want to have a little punt, if you're not sure about it, just put a little bit of money in and wait and see what happens and do some research.
Mm.
Because as one of the largest fund managers in the 80s and 90s said, he said he ran a big fund called Magellan over in the United States for Fidelity. He said, I'm constantly amazed how everybody does the research for their car, for their refrigerator, for their TV, yada, yada. And then, you know, excuse me, the cab driver or the bus driver or the mate at the pub says, oh, buy some of these, they're going up, and they put everything in there. So the most important thing to understand is that nothing is a sure bet, but some companies are going to be a better bet than others. And you have to learn to differentiate between the risk of what is a punt versus what is a quality share for the longer term.
Fair enough. What countries are you finding at this point in the environment that we are in, where what share market particularly are you finding the most interesting? S&P 500 or is the ASX or Russia?
Yeah, I tend to only run money in Australia and then into the US. That's enough for little old me to do on my lonesome. If I wanted emerging market exposure, I'd do it through an ETF product. Ditto with the European markets. But I kind of, from my own personal experience, I don't jump on and off different markets. So I'm quite happy to let the China market race away. I don't feel the need to be in there. But of course, some people would say, you know, we've got a US dollar weakening and emerging markets always do very well in a US dollar weakening scenario. So you're probably going to continue to see money moving in that direction, particularly since the US market has moved away. What people will find over time is that funds swirl around the system. Money is always looking for a good return. So you'll see it flip into one specific sector or one asset class and it'll run there, and then the traders will take lots of profits and they'll move on to somewhere else. If you're an investor for the longer term, when that all that momentum and that money comes out of a certain sector, that's a good time to go and buy it if you know your company and you have confidence in the longer term because of the quality of management and the operations. That is always a great time to go in and buy. So at the moment, my money is just split between Australia and the US, and I'm actually sitting on quite a bit of cash because I'm not convinced that we're out of the woods yet.
Normally sitting on the cash in this kind of environment is a pretty good thing. I mean, it's that's the safest bet that you want to have. But with the amount of QE that is being done by Fed and you can argue Australia as well, but let's talk Fed. That's the biggest market, right? Holding onto too much cash, a worrisome thing as well, because it's being debased at the fastest rate. And gold is your perfect example of that. You can just see gold shooting up.
Yeah. Well, I've actually got some gold as well, more through the ETF rather than the physical. No, you're absolutely right. And that's why there's so much money coming into the market. And that's why actually, if you look for pullbacks, it's hard to tell how much they're going to pull back because nobody wants to have their cash in the bank at the moment. And I guess it depends on who you are personally. I am one that needs to protect my capital to a certain degree. If you're young and you still have income, I wouldn't sit on any cash because if you're in the position where you continue to add to your portfolio, you wouldn't sit on cash because you would say, okay, well, I can buy this share at $100 and if it falls to $85, I'll just buy some more because I've got money coming in through the door. The reason I have cash is that I am not actively in a job receiving a weekly wage and therefore I have to protect to some degree my capital. So when you get a big drawdown event like March, I'm in a position theoretically to put money into the market. So you can see it varies depending on who you are and what your own financial position is. Makes no sense at all for someone like, you know, my son who's still earning money through tutoring and this, that and the other, and his mother's looking after him. He's putting money into the market because for him, cash is just, you know, literally, as they say, burning a hole in your pocket.
When you are working your returns on the share market, how would you go about doing it when the unit of measure is what I call it, not even consistent? Like it's essentially you've got a scale today that is 10 centimeters long. Tomorrow it's going to be 20 centimeters long. In a month's time, it's going to be 30 centimeters long, right? So essentially your unit of measure is changing or being debased at the fastest rate, right? So how are you calculating?
You're talking about money printing debasing. Exactly. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
but the US dollar's a tricky one at the moment because obviously you've got to, it depends when you bought your US dollars, doesn't it? Because if you bought them higher up, then you're still sitting sweat. If you bought it at 55 cents, then clearly you know, you're having some issues. But I assume if you went and bought US dollars at a lower level, you were taking a long-term view that you're diversifying your assets away from Australia, let's say, and it's a currency hedge against something happening in Australia, and you're also taking a view on the stocks that go up in the future. I think for personal investors, they get too bogged down in this thing about performance the whole time. It's you're there to make money, but when you look at the benchmark for what is making money, so historically, according to Market Index, which everyone can Google, it's a website and it's got lots of great charts and returns of share prices and the index. Since 1900, the Australian market, so the ASX 200 didn't exist, so it was, you know, tracking all the way through. But it has performed on average 11.8% per annum since 1900. However, that was up to about a year ago, I think, and it also includes dividends. And Australia typically has had a higher dividend payout yield than other countries. So if we assume that in a low interest rate world, which we currently have, we can't assume that we're going to make those returns anymore. We're probably looking at 5 to 6% on average. And even, you know, at that sort of mark, you're probably going to double your money every, you know, just over 10, 11 years, which I would say is a good result. I don't like to invest saying I have to make this amount of money each year. I think it puts too much pressure on someone. As a retail investor, you don't have to perform like a professional investor. You're not benchmarking yourself against an index. You are trying to manage your own personal risk of how much capital you have, how much you can put in the market, and how much you can put in the market going forward. And they're very, very different things. So for me, and it is a very personal thing, I don't try and push my investments, okay, to say I have to do 5 or 10% a year, because I find I make mistakes when I try and push it too quickly. Because when you push it, you go into a higher risk category. Classic example, right? Late 1990s. Huge internet, you know, the whole internet thing when I lived in London, there were internet drinks parties. People would go to networking events to discuss the next big thing on the internet, right? I'm there going, equity markets are too expensive, because they had rallied and they had rallied and they had rallied. And I didn't want to put my money into equities. So instead, I got involved with this amazing new technology. So it was kind of like a private equity venture that had come out of the East Coast of America. There was a very rich American guy that arrived in London looking for reasonably high net worth individuals to put money into a nanotechnology company that was working in conjunction with MIT. So it was to basically get an accelerated platform for the transfer, the digital transfer of information, right? Great technology, potentially huge money maker, did so well, went in on the first tranche, I doubled my capital. Then we suddenly heard the Vanderbilts or the JP Morgan family wanted to buy in. Did I want to sell? Oh, no, 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 I'll hold it for the longer term. You know what happened? The owner of the company bankrupted it and stole the technology, right? So my experience in this area, right, is that every time I try and force to put my money into another area, I can come unstuck. So I say, don't force it. You have to be patient. The opportunities will arrive unless you're going to do dollar cost averaging, let's say, into, you know, an index. So if you were lucky enough, I was quite fully invested when the crash came in March. And I must admit, I first hand up, I completely underestimated this pandemic. And because I was quite fully invested and I'd made lots of money, lo and behold, I couldn't go in and buy more at the bottom. And I actually went into a capital preservation mode. So the point is that the great opportunities are going to present themselves. And I think because the cycles of ups and downs, the peaks and the troughs are getting far more concentrated. So if you know that you've got cash coming through the door, sometimes it's worth saying, like, okay, I am a Tesla fan, but do I really want to buy it at $1,600? No. It's a great long-term story, but, you know, it's really discounting way too much at this stage. Just wait, be a bit patient, come back, because everything moves in cycles. And even though the long-term secular trend is upwards, it's just at what point do you jump on board? So hopefully that makes sense. But I do not believe that you try and chase returns. That's a classic bull market thing. And unfortunately, I think that's one of the things that I get really upset for poor new investors is they kind of push it too quickly, too hard, and then they get so badly burnt that they never come back into the market again.
Fair enough. Oh, that's good. Now, Warren Buffett has got a famous thing that he always says, buy, hold, and forget kind of thing, right?
Yep.
Do you think that is still a good strategy, especially looking at what's going on? I mean, and that's normally a term that's used in real estate a lot as well. How do you see that statement and whether it still will hold true in the future and whether it's really worked in the past?
It's really interesting because there's been research that's actually done about the companies that have created wealth in the American share market. And it's research, if anyone wants to Google, a guy called Henrik Bessenbinder. Mm-hmm. And he calculates just how few companies actually create the big wealth. I think you have to be circumspect sometimes of a set and forget approach.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that when you're on a winner, so I got told when Amazon was $600 or $700 in 2016, don't buy it. And I said, no, I'm going to buy it. Oh, it's way too expensive. Well, I did buy it, thankfully, and it's, you know, $3,000. To me, in this period of change, Amazon is a company that you can stick with, right? It's not going to go up and down usually 25, 30% every second. It's too big, but I still think it has growth. You have to be careful with the set and forget. And the trick is always finding those really good companies that can actually disrupt themselves, because that's so important at the moment. The level of disruption is just huge, but has the cash flow to invest to actually create their future growth. So investors need to be, I think, a little bit circumspect and review the portfolio maybe once every year or something with those set and forget ones. The thing is, when you get a set and forget right, it's going to be a game changer. And I'm sure someone's told you, I wrote about it in the book, if you invested in CSL at the IPO with $3,000, you've got $1 million in the bank now. Now, of course, $3,000 back in the early 90s was a decent amount of money. But, you know, who wouldn't want $1 million in the bank? And when you compare it to property, it's really interesting because I think people have got a little bit lazy with property. They just think every property goes up. Well, no, every property doesn't go up. And property now has a whole lot of other risks involved with it. You've got things like a climate change risk. It's a very real risk. You're seeing it up here in New South Wales. Very expensive properties in Wamberal are falling into, you know, the sea. And you're also seeing different locations not performing the same way. I could even say post-World War II, people were not investing property. They were actually selling property around the globe because demographically you did not have the population to support property. So I think good investors, even Warren Buffett, he reviews his portfolio. He doesn't get it right all the time. I mean, he sold the airlines at the bottom of the market, but who would have thought a whole lot of Robin Hood traders would come in and buy the airlines at the bottom of the market when they're not a viable business model?
Hertz is always the greatest example, the company that went bankrupt and the stock price went up.
Like, oh, crazy stuff. Crazy, crazy, crazy stuff.
So you think Australian property is overvalued?
Oh, geez, I'm no expert there. All I'll say to people is that Australian property is dependent upon immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, but having said that, there's a lot of people too that would like to get on the property ladder, but I think it's incredibly hard for them because you need such a large deposit and it's really hard to save, you know, when there's very low interest rates and therefore by default you move up the risk curve to invest in the share market to try and make enough money to possibly put together a deposit for a property. So it's not easy. It's not easy for people.
Pretty hard to jump on these days with the amount of deposit that's required. But it was always, at the same time, having said that, it was always hard. It never was easy to jump on the property lender in this country. So
yeah, it's an interesting dilemma. I did some work for my first book on this. So what you've had is that you may be it's the affordability. So interest rates have come down, but everybody can now take a much larger loan. And that's the problem. We've had this amazing growth in asset prices since the beginning of the 1980s, because interest rates have just gone consecutively down from 18% to zero.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite pick in the share market currently for the next whatever time frame, 3 to 5 years?
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, it's a bit annoying because in my book I would have said Tesla, but it's already gone up so much, so I'm a little bit hamstrung on that one at the moment. I probably still would say I think that man Elon Musk is going to change the world, and the world doesn't realise it. But I just couldn't justify it at this point in time. I don't really like doing great, one-off stock picks. I like, if I had to say anything, I think the telehealth sector is really interesting. There's some great companies in Australia, the ResMeds, the Cochlears. There's a new one, MedAdvisor, which is very small. Mm-hmm. I think that it really is going to be a sector that's going to transform itself. Mm-hmm. And I think there are going to be opportunities for investors that companies that aren't even listed at the moment that mm-hmm. are going to come to the market. And again, things in the likes of data analytics, big, big growth market, huge growth market. And I think there might be one, I think it's called Nexius or something, that Macquarie Bank has some capital in. Mm-hmm. And it was mooted they might be coming into the market, and they do a lot of data analytics. So, and there's one in America, I think, called Snowflake, which might be coming to the market. But just be careful, because I think people get caught on trends, whether it's cannabis, whether it's lithium, whether it's EVs, and you get bubbles occurring with these big themes. So you have to say, when you have a bubble that goes on and everybody wants to be on that train, you also get a lot of Me Too companies. So you're seeing that at the moment now in the buy now, pay later sector. Clearly it's been a growth market. As to its longevity and whether or not they can justify the valuations, well, we'll only tell. But you have to be quite selective, that realising that sometimes there's a lot of momentum behind a sector theme. Mm-hmm. But when the music stops, whoops, down go the share prices.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. Changing gears a little bit, Daniel. Aliens, believe it or not.
Did you say aliens?
Yep. you believe in Elon Musk. So.
We're not the only ones. I'm pretty sure about that.
So you are a believer.
Oh, look. Hey, it's a big universe, isn't it?
AI. Do you think AI is a threat to humanity?
Oh, that's a good question. Someone got really uppity the other day on Twitter because the United Arab Emirates have sent up a rocket called Hope to Mars. Mm-hmm. And this is the other day. And there is a space race on at the moment, as you're aware of, for Mars. And they said, this is so terrible because climate change is so much more important. And I personally think climate change is a real problem for humanity. That's my personal thing. The finance industry is moving in that direction as well. So I don't want to debate whether it's anthropogenic or not. Mm-hmm. But I thought in the back of my mind, given the state of geopolitics in the world at the moment, when you've got two effectively bulls in Trump and Xi Jinping clashing at each other to try and get re-election. So they're externalizing, right? They're trying to blame each other for their own internal problems. Mm-hmm. You go, what's going to be the thing that upends humanity? I mean, we have lived in the greatest peacetime for so many years. Like my generation, I always go, you don't realize how lucky like the 50, 60 year olds, because they've never had war. They've never had to go to war. And I go, there's so many big issues at the moment, and it's not only, AI, because left unchecked, of course it could be a problem. But then you get potentially two major powers and somebody gets a bit cranky and they suddenly decide to push the button. Then we've got a game changer there. And I think, unfortunately, there's so much happening at the moment that you almost need to take your mind away from that and believe what I said to another podcast that I did. They said, are you bullish or are you positive? And I said, the thing that I've learned through this pandemic is the ability of humanity to start to adapt and adapt quickly and change and companies moving to be at the forefront of ingenuity. And the one thing about humans is we will always look for a way to make money. And that's always going to come through. And I think we have to be positive that humanity is going to get through this. And if we overthink all the risks, then we will never do anything. So there's a way to invest positively with your money for positive change as well.
Well said. That's really well said. Crypto, here to stay or a fad?
So here we go. Here's another story. A few years ago when I sold all my bank shares and I'm looking for ideas and I wanted to get into growth stories and I was Googling away, how do I buy this Bitcoin? You know, pants off trying to find out how to get involved. And of course it was way beyond me. Like it was still quite embryonic, etc. I think the whole concept of cryptocurrencies, I'm no expert, but I think they're here to stay. Like anything, it's like the internet 20 years ago. Everybody didn't know. Everyone wanted to make money out of the internet, but it was very embryonic. And a lot of them didn't know how to do it. They just had great ideas. I think crypto probably at some point is going to be some form of monetary payment in this, what will have a monetary value ascribed to it, like an asset, because we're living in a crazy world where, you know, central banks are going to have to keep on printing money. And I think the big boys take it seriously, but like anything, is how does it move from maybe being a more speculative asset class to actually having some form of function with a value that can be ascribed to it? And that's the problem. I mean, gold has a value because people literally perceive if the world ends, I've still got my gold. You put it under the bed, or your diamonds, for example. Whereas I'm not sure people are convinced about the crypto, but I don't think it's going away, no.
Fair enough. That's a good point. It's a network effect thing. Gold has got that centuries of network effect, whereas this is fairly nascent technology. So there's a non-zero chance it can go down to zero, without a doubt. I really enjoyed the conversation, Daniel. Thanks for all the insights in the share market space. We are learning about share markets. By no means we are experts in that space, along with a lot of the other stuff. Any other tips that you would like to leave listeners with before we wrap this up?
Yeah, never stop learning.
That's exactly what we're doing here.
Really important. Read, never stop learning, and have an open mind. And I think be receptive to change. Also, sell your losers. Don't hold on to them. Really important. Learn to sell the losers. Otherwise, you end up with the proverbial bottom drawer of stocks that are never going to recover.
That's a really good point. And check out Daniel's book, Shareplicity, and hopefully we'll learn a lot more. Thanks for that.
Thanks very much, Jazz. Take care.
If you have any questions or feedback about today's episode, you can reach out to us through sparkyourfirepodcast@gmail.com. That's sparkyourfirepodcast, all one word, @gmail.com. Also, the content discussed in this episode is general in nature. Please seek specific advice from qualified professionals in regards to your personal situation.